Good evening. Many of you know that the founder, or historians say that the founder of Zen was a Bodhidharma, who was an Indian monk born in the 5th century, India. And he was born into the highest class. He was born into the Brahmin class, the priest class. And he was a very brilliant young man and very strong feeling for seeking the truth. And he associated with the best known priests and scholars of the day in India. He was very well educated. And he became Buddhist at a very, very early age, when he was infant, just past infancy. And he had such a way about him. His teacher noticed he was a kind of special, and his teacher told him to go to China and bring the practice there. So he did. He went from India to China, and it is said that the trip took 3 years. Good old days. Hard trip, 3 years. Now, during his time, around the 5th century in China, there were two main dynasties, the North and South dynasties. Now, as far as, and Buddhism was there. Buddhism was in China, but it wasn't, it was pretty much academic. And the Northern dynasty emphasized meditation and various techniques, esoteric techniques, magic techniques and meditation, whereas the Southern dynasty was very intellectual and philosophical, many discussions going on all the time, and debates amongst the aristocrats and the academics. By the late fifth century, Buddhism was growing in the north. There were temples being built. Many men were being ordained as monks and clergymen, and even the common people were getting involved. Buddhism was getting down to the street level, and that was in the north. But in the south, it was still confined to the educated elite and the ruling classes. Such as the royalty. And it stayed that way for another 100 years. Now, the historians don't agree on exactly what Bodhidharma did when he wound up in China. So one particular account says he stayed in the south for many years and visited various temples and priests, and maybe, they say, maybe that's how he learned Chinese, just hanging out in the south all those years. On the other hand, other people say, well, maybe he learned his Chinese on the boat. So we don't know exactly. And after some years in the south, he finally requested an audience with the emperor, Emperor Wu. But there's another account of what Bodhidharma did when he came to China, that is that immediately upon arriving, he was invited to visit the emperor. As soon as he set foot on shore, he was asked to come and visit the emperor. And this was in the south. This was in Nanking. It's called the Liang Dynasty. Anyway, the emperor in the south was a very devout Buddhist. But eventually Bodhidharma did visit the emperor. And again, the historians are not sure what happened, but so the stories vary in what was said when they finally did meet. Stories are different, but the essence of the story is the same. So when Bodhidharma had an audience with the emperor said to him, since I became the emperor, I have built many temples. I've had many of the Buddha's sutras translated and copied from Indian to Chinese. And I have provided support to hundreds of monks so they can just continue their studies and bring the teachings to the people. And then he uttered the famous line, "How much merit have I earned?" And Bodhidharma replied the famous line, "No merit." And the emperor was very surprised. He thought he'd really earned the merit. You know, did a lot of things. Bodhidharma said, "No merit." So the emperor was astonished and said, "Well, why? Why is there no merit from all that I've done?" And Bodhidharma said something like, "The activities that you describe are simply small deeds, little deeds of men. They're just a way to gain the rewards of recognition. They are like shadows that follow the body around. They may seem real to you, but they are not real." The emperor said, "Well, what is true merit?" Bodhidharma said, "True merit is the subtle understanding of wisdom, which is silent and void. And it cannot be pursued according to the ways of the world." By now the emperor was totally confused, shocked, disappointed, and he said, "So then what is the first principle of the sacred doctrine? In other words, what is the foundation of teaching the truth?" And Bodhidharma said, "Emptiness, no holiness." But now the emperor was so frustrated, he demanded to know, "Who is it that stands in front of me?" And Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." They say this was the first Zen lecture, the first Zen teaching. According to the story, Bodhidharma left the palace and he now went to the north, the Northern Dynasty, where he was supposed to have sat in Zazen facing the wall for 9 years. And there's still a lot of speculation about what this means. What is the meaning of this image? Bodhidharma faced the wall for 9 years. That's a very famous story of Bodhidharma and the emperor. And this story is studied and speculated until today by Zen monks in training. What does that mean? But we do know that Bodhidharma's practice was very strict. That is, there was no fooling around, and he cut right through. His idea was to cut right through to the truth in any conversation. And he was strict with people who he felt should know better. And Suzuki Roshi often talked about Bodhidharma. Suzuki Roshi admired Bodhidharma's practice and attitude. When Bodhidharma came before the emperor, he immediately knew the mind of the emperor. He knew the emperor's state of mind. So he responded in ways to the emperor's questions to cut right through all the superficiality and to get to the heart of things. Bodhidharma put great emphasis on practice as the expression of true nature. And he emphasized practice as the way to unfold wisdom. The only way to unfold wisdom. Subtle wisdom that is silent and in the void. Bodhidharma had no patience with intellect, the use of the intellect to learn the Dharma, and he had no use for philosophical study. And it is said he left the South after his meeting with the emperor. He left the South and he went to the North to get away from a kind of cocktail party type of Buddhism. You know, when you go to someone's house and talk about the Buddhist book you read. So he went to the North and sat facing the wall. Buddhism had already been in China since the early years of since the early centuries of this common era. You know, after Christ, Buddhism found its way to China through the visits of monks from India who brought teachings and sutras. And translation of the sutras from Indian to Chinese were done by various scholars who were supported by the emperor. So Buddhist scholars were there, Buddhist monks, and Confucian monks, Indian monks, all helped to bring the Buddhist teaching into China through the written word. And of course the king, the emperor helped with his wealth. And what occurred is that the individuals who translated some particular teaching from Indian to Chinese, you know, you have to work hard to do that. That's hard. Not only the translation, but this new philosophy, this new way of understanding, this new view of the world, the Buddhist view. So, working so hard at it, they came to understand and appreciate the very deep meaning of what it was they were translating. They became very, very attached to it. And they developed a very deep feeling and a personal interest in what it was they were translating. And of course, it was more than one scholar, more than one monk would translate something, because the sutra is so vast. So many people naturally came together and had a common interest in some teaching, and they would tend to elevate that one above all the others. And so that's how the various Buddhist schools were formed in China. Because a certain group of translators developed an interest in something, and others developed a deep interest in something else because they were translators. So schools were formed by the very careful study and the creation of a particular philosophy and based on their intellectual study and discussions. So, and even though they practice meditation, all of them, their understanding of the teaching was based on philosophy and the use of their intellect and the reasoning, and their reasoning through what they were translating. So various groups, within various groups, their zazen included contemplating one of the profound teachings, the one they had worked on. That was their favorite. So they were all influenced a little bit differently, even though they were all practicing zazen together. And because there was such intellectual activity and philosophical activity in learning the teachings, they hadn't come across the principles of Zen practice, so they were aiming to gain some kind of high state of understanding through their study and through their philosophical discussions. They felt the aim of this study was to gain some kind of understanding that they did not have. Bodhidharma arrived in the 6th century with a much different understanding of the practice. Much different. Bodhidharma's practice was not about emphasizing one particular teaching. And the practice that we have today that was given to us by Suzuki Roshi is reflection, expression of Bodhidharma's understanding of what practice is. In our practice today, we don't emphasize, we don't embrace some particular teaching, even though we may be very fond of one. And that can happen. We could fall in love. It's possible to fall in love or be profoundly influenced by one teaching. You know the story of the 6th patriarch. When he was a peasant in some village somewhere, working as a woodcutter, selling firewood to support himself and his elderly mother. And one day, while he was collecting firewood, he heard somebody reciting the Diamond Sutra. And he said to somebody, "What's that? What do I hear?" Somebody, and he said, was told, "Well, that's the Diamond Sutra." What is that? I have to learn more about it. And the man said, "Well, you better go visit the 5th patriarch." So the 6th patriarch, the man who became the 6th patriarch, he arranged to have somebody take care of his mother, and he took off. Because he heard somebody reciting the Diamond Sutra. So it's possible to become very fond of one teaching or the other, but we don't emphasize it above all others in our practice. And our practice is not about attaining some higher state of wisdom through some particular teaching. Because if we were to do that, if that were to happen, we would be creating some kind of special practice for a few people, selected people. Only those who liked this sutra or this one. We would be creating a practice just for this class of people. And that's not universal practice. So Bodhidharma said, you know, stop all that speculating and just practice. And that's the attitude that, that's the view that Suzuki Roshi brought to us. So in Buddhism in China in its very early days was very aristocratic, supported by the emperor and his royal court. And so it became very narrow and ornate, based on idea of something special and something unique. So the majority of lay people, they didn't have any interest in that. They were shut out. They were not interested in hearing the teachings from the aristocrats. And the aristocrats and the scholars didn't care. They didn't have the attitude that says, we have to help the common people understand. They didn't care if the farmers and the merchants lost interest. They kept philosophizing and studying whatever it was their favorite. This is the environment that Bodhidharma found. And it explains his meeting. It explains what happened in his meeting with the Emperor Wu. So in America today, I think we still have some of this very same problem. Many people think that Zen is something special only for particular people. It doesn't apply to everybody. Just a few of us, they might say. Oh, this is just for a few of us special people. I think that's changing, but still now people may think that Zen is only for great scholars or great intellects or people who have fantastic spiritual capacity. And if that were true, Zen would be nothing more than just a sect. And it wouldn't much help ordinary people. But that's not our practice. And we have to try to help overcome such ideas that it is special and unique. Only for a select few. It's a misunderstanding. That was Emperor Wu's understanding. Several centuries later, after Dogen brought Zen practice from China to Japan in the 13th century, the Soto school that he founded grew and developed by helping ordinary people understand practice. Brought the practice to the farmers, so they say. Whether the people were intellectually gifted or not, whether they understood the teachings intellectually, or even whether they did zazen, the monks of the Soto school simply tried to show the practice to everybody and didn't discriminate based on people's individual capacities. Everybody was the same, was their message. The illiterate farmer was the same as the gifted scholar. So the Soto school developed a concern for all people, was not concerned with individual personal attainment. And people warmly welcomed this approach. The Soto school made the practice available to everybody without discrimination. And so the Soto school in Japan grew very large. Today it's still the largest Zen sect in Japan. And in addition, the Soto school that we are part of, from the very beginning, supported itself. Wasn't dependent on influential people, and rarely asked for outside help. So when Dogen became known in Japan, became a little famous, the government, the governor, asked him to help him understand the teachings. And you know what Bodhidharma said? He didn't say read this book. He said, become a monk and practice hard. So the Soto school was known to be known as Farmer Zen. Did not take support from outside, supported itself. So in our lineage, in our school, for us, there's no such thing as a single great person or a farmer. Everybody is the same. Although, of course, we do sometimes tend to think that Suzuki Roshi was pretty great. But he taught us to stop that. Don't do that. So in our practice, everyone is a Buddhist equally. No one is a better Buddhist than anyone else, and everyone is a Zen student equally. Our understanding is that everyone is practicing, even if they're not on their cushion. When we feel this way, then we have a very wide and accepting mind. And we are ready to be helpful everywhere or anywhere. So the Zen we have today developed over the centuries, hundreds of years, without Zen developed without glorifying any particular teaching. And we studied the various teachings, but just to encourage our practice. We don't look to pick out the best one. We have no need to depend on a special teaching, even if we become very fond of it. Because the fundamental teaching, when you take Bodhidharma's view and see that the fundamental teaching is simply that everything is transient, when we understand the practice, when we understand this through our practice and not through our intellect, everything is transient. So the emperor says to Bodhidharma, who stands here in front of me? Who are you? I don't know. And then he goes, like the wind. Everything is transient. I don't know. So the most important point for us, if we really want to know this practice, is to be careful not to become attached to it as an idea. And don't ever think that the practice is not universal, that it ends at the edge of some territory. So our attitude is just as Bodhidharma's, cut through to the source of the truth, and don't create any particular belief system in a teaching or an individual or a temple or anything like that. Just teaching is the same, practice is the same wherever we go, truth is the same wherever we go, everyone is equal no matter where we are. Whether our practice place is big and comfortable or small and cramped makes no difference. Nothing special. Does anyone have a question? Scott.
Is there more to Zen than mindfulness?
More to?
Zen than mindfulness?
Oh, yes. Yes. Eightfold Path. Mindfulness is number 7.
Throughout the world, in Zen temples, everyone chants the Heart Sutra. But there's no attachment to that idea. The idea is held there. It seems like there are some ideas in Zen that are sort of like there is a fundamental philosophy that would be articulated in the Heart Sutra. But that's sort of secondary?
Did you say all Zen temples?
I heard that.
Okay, so we're all doing the same thing.
Yeah.
That's all you need to know. Yes, Vanessa.
Do you have a recommendation practically how to go about not always looking through the prism of Zen philosophy? I find I do that a lot, that I get caught up in thinking in a Zen way, and I catch myself doing it, and I realize I'm thinking in a Zen way. I'm not approaching the situation truthfully. How do we not get caught up?
What's a Zen way?
Like I recall something I've heard or something I've read, a phrase or a line from a sutra. I don't know, something like this, rather than experiencing something
okay.
without these words and not through this prism.
Okay. Well, it's normal, and I think it's necessary. Of course, when we are first starting practice, we are influenced and impressed and guided by what we hear, and so we fall back on that as for guidance. But after a while, it becomes second nature, and we're guided without thinking about it. But it takes some practice and some training to drop off the tendency that you just talked about. After a while, that'll go away. You'll find the guidance, or you'll feel the guidance, but you won't be able to say to yourself, oh, I just remembered this statement. Mm-hmm. That won't happen anymore. You just flow naturally. But in the beginning, that's very normal. Yes, please.
So, I read a book on Bodhidharma, and it talks about that he had only two students, and they kind of they had to plead a lot to become students. He didn't want to take students or something, and he didn't teach them much. He was just sitting in the cave, and I think he left a couple of books, and they disappeared. But what do you think is the significance of, I mean, he's not like a normal teacher, kind of, it's a little different. What do you think is the significance of him doing something like that? I mean, he came to a different country to teach, but he didn't teach much. So, seems strange.
Hmm. Ooh. There's another way to teach besides using words. And that was his understanding. And he must have shown that understanding at an early age when his teacher in India said, well, go to China. You know, in the 5th or 6th centuries, in 6th century in China, it was already 800 years since Buddha's birth. So by then there were thousands of Buddhist ministers and priests, and his teacher said, go, get out of here. Go to where they really need you. So the emperor says, well, I've had all these sutras translated. Bodhidharma says, you know, like, so what? No merit. So his way of teaching was beyond words. And if people paid attention when he was there, they would understand something. And if they didn't pay attention, they would miss it. In fact, part of the story of his encounter with the emperor, when the emperor says, so who is it here in front of me? Bodhidharma says, I don't know, and then he leaves. And the legend says that the minister turned to one of his counselors and said, who was that? And where did he go? And the counselor says, I don't know, but we missed a great opportunity. Something like that. The counselor understood something. Anyway, it's all part of the legend that he didn't come there to teach, but to be straightforward. Thank you. Yes, Sylvia. He intuitively picked up all of the signs, which included tone of voice, choice of words, body language, the behavior of the other people in the room. He saw, you know, the big picture all at once. stepped into the room, palace room, and his mind immediately said, I know what's going on here. You don't, nobody has to explain to me what's going on here. I get it. His awareness was so advanced, his intuition was so advanced that he got, what do we say, he got the vibes immediately. Yes, please.
The no merit thing.
No merit.
Yes, it really caught my attention to a lot of practices, whether it's Buddhism or Zen or any other religious practices from America. It's like, you know, there are people, priests, or people who have been practicing it for years, and they're seriously into it. For some reason, when you see them in a temple or you know, in some kind of a group where they actually practice it day and night, very few have this no merit understanding. Like if you go to a temple or something, it's like always you see that some kind of big, huge merit kind of a personality. And it's not the person, but it's also the environment and the people who give that merit. For some, you know, like how Suzuki Roshi said, don't give me that merit, it's okay, right? So it's always a tendency. The person may not give merit to himself or herself after a long practice or deep practice, but it's the people around them, the practice kind of give the merit. And some people feel that that's not for them, or that environment is not for them. So when you said the farmer and the philosopher, everybody, the Japanese Zen practice open for everyone. That for me is really practice that is opening doors for everyone without having the no merit, without having the merit feeling. Because it's very important. Many times it is a hesitation for a common person, as a new person, to go into it because of the merit and the no merit kind of feeling. So, you know, how do we what is the right word? How do we enforce the no merit thing anywhere? I mean, it's not just in this practice, but in the real world too.
You cannot enforce it. The whole idea that there is something called merit, it's a mistaken idea. Somebody made it up because of the desire to gain something from this effort. Every effort has to have some payoff. You know, this is the way we think. This is the way people think. But if you sit long enough and steady enough, if you start out by saying, "I will be gaining. I'll gain from this. I certainly will gain from this," and after a while. Well, where is it? And you don't feel a gain of anything. And so you start to let go of the idea. And you start to feel something different from just practicing. If there is anything called merit in this practice, it has to do with humility and confidence and understanding. That's the merit we speak of. But it's not a merit that the emperor wanted, a merit that would raise him up in the eyes of people. So if you practice enough, the idea of merit diminishes. But you can't convince people of that. They have to find out themselves. Yes, Anna.
If a moment arises in practice that feels that sense of holiness instead of emptiness, what would you suggest?
If a feeling arises
that feels that sense of holiness instead of emptiness, what would you suggest?
Do you become very attached to this feeling of holiness?
No. In life, every once in a while, you know, that sense comes up in everyday life, not always.
That this is something special, you mean?
It's a nice feeling, I think.
Is it a problem?
Maybe if that's the motivation to practice, it's a problem. But not currently for me, though. It could become a problem if that becomes the motivation. I could see that.
Well, if you have good awareness, you know, and you feel some sense of pride or specialness arise or a sense of holiness, your awareness will tell you, whoops, let's put that aside. But you know, we get tired of that. Oh, this is so holy. Oh, this is so wonderful. And afterwards, you say, what am I doing? You get tired of it. You see, that was a mistake. That was short-sighted. So it's actually no problem if you just stick with the practice and you get beyond that. No problem. Thank you. Oh, excuse me.
That was quite a history, the story of all that. But I want to kind of just talk about some problem. I think it is a problem in some ways. But it's almost like I can count on coming here on Wednesday evening and coming, as they say, to this stop. And my mind settles. I can almost count on it. And then I start to feel really tired, as if my mind has been sped up for 7 days or more. And then I come here, and I can almost count on attaining being tired. So I was wondering if there's some... I mean, I kind of like that, on one hand. Because it feels like I'm being charged, but it's almost like sometimes I feel like I'm wasting my time because I'm not fully having to fight, having my forehead hit the wall. So I'm just kind of wondering if you know of a certain, what's that about? And I mean, it is what it is, I guess, and that's what I'm doing. Or maybe it's just not my time to be meditating or trying to meditate.
So you'd rather not be tired?
Pardon me?
You'd rather not be tired?
I don't know if say that. Seems like one of the things I've noticed as a pattern, I can almost count on it that this is something that's going to happen.
Okay.
So I don't know if there's ways that... Anyway. I don't know what to...
So you'd prefer not to be tired?
I suppose while I'm here, maybe afterwards. I mean, I hear it among many other people too. I mean, it's just one of the things that happens, not necessarily at 7:10 on Wednesday evenings, but it's something that other people I've noticed, they mention this, and it's one of the things that happens, apparently. It's not uncommon where one's mind has been cooking and it kind of come to a stop and things kind of settle and you know, you realize actually how tired you are.
Well, so you practice tired.
Practice tired?
If you're tired, you practice tired.
Mm-hmm.
If you're energetic, you practice energetic. Mm-hmm. You practice just as you are in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
But if you start wishing to be in a different state, you can practice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, I wish I wasn't so sleepy. Then there's your mind. So up there looking for unsleepiness or something like that. You just have to stay with what you are.
Well, one of the things I've heard is an example of a horse, you know, holding onto a horse. If you're sitting in this offer, if you lean forward, the horse, you can't control it too well. If you lean back, the horse can buck, so you try and... He basically was talking about re-erecting the posture. That seems in some ways what I guess I try to do.
Yeah, sit as straight as you can.
Okay.